This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, the space race is on for business. We talk about some of the people and ambitions behind a new space race with the author of the new book, When the Heavens Went on Sale. Now, former President Donald Trump participated in a town hall event on CNN last week as he's running for the office again in the 2024 election. The television network received widespread criticism for how the program was handled, with CNN correspondent Caitlin Collins trying to moderate in front of a vocal, largely pro-Trump crowd. The event produced strong ratings for CNN, but it stirred up questions of how journalists and the media should cover Trump and his latest presidential campaign. He's the current Republican frontrunner and can't be ignored, but he often repeats lies and repeats misinformation. He's been indicted on 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. The list goes on. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you watch CNN's town hall event with Trump? What did you think about it? Do you think CNN could have, should have handled it differently? If so, how? How do you think the media should cover Trump in general and the candidates, the open field for president in general, too? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Tom Nichols is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he's lead writer for their flagship newsletter called The Daily. He's the author of several books, including Our Own Worst Enemy, The Assault from Within on Modern Democracy. And in last night's episode of the hit HBO show Succession, he played the role of a conservative political commentator on a fictional news network that was covering a presidential election controversy in Wisconsin. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back.
In a recent piece you wrote, you have no problem with CNN or anyone covering Trump. You think they should do that. Your problem, though, I think, was with how this town hall format worked. What did you see going wrong there?
Well, from beginning to end, first having a crowd that was clapping and cheering, who was obviously there to treat it like a rally, having a reporter who just was overmatched by Trump. He just swatted her out of the way repeatedly. The whole format was designed to make look Trump like a normal politician, which he most certainly is not. And instead of, sitting him down one-on-one and saying, you really have to answer some difficult questions. Exhorted people to march on the Capitol. You've said, you've been found liable for sexual abuse. And instead, the Caitlin Collins, I think, was stuck in this, no-win situation where no matter what she asked him, he was just going to speechify and do what he does. And the crowd was going to clap. So to me, this was just a poorly designed event from beginning to end.
Let's give a listen to Caitlin Collins here asking Trump about the classified documents seized from his Mar-a-Lago home in Florida.
When it comes to your documents, did you ever show those classified documents to anyone?
Not really. I would have the right to. By the way, they were declassified.
What do you mean, not really?
Not that I can think of. Let me just tell you, I have the absolute right to do whatever I want with them. I have the right. I was negotiating with NARA. Do you know what NARA is?
The National Archives.
Extremely left group of people. Extremely left. And I was negotiating with them. All of a sudden, they raided my house. They didn't raid the house of Joe Biden. They didn't raid Obama.
But Joe Biden didn't ignore a subpoena to get those documents back like you did.
And so that's the question. 1,850 boxes.
But that's the question that investigators have, I think, is why you held on to those documents when you knew the federal government was seeking them and then had given you a subpoena to return them.
Are you ready? Are you ready? Can I talk?
Yeah, what's the answer?
Do you mind?
I would like for you to answer the question.
Okay, it's very simple to answer.
That's why I asked it.
It's very simple to... You're a nasty person, I'll tell you.
So you don't see a lot of benefit to the democratic process there, Tom?
No, and that didn't come until the very end. I mean, this was finally, her losing patience with him and him losing patience with her. You notice that by the end of that, we've left behind the not... Did you show these to anybody? Not really. You said, did you or didn't you? Did you actually share classified material with other people? It's a yes or no question, Mr. Trump. But the problem is that you can't fact check him in real time. The truth means nothing to him. And in that sense, like I said, it was just Caitlin Collins was in a no-win scenario, especially when the crowd, he's just drawing energy off the crowd. The crowd was there to support him. I had asked CNN about this when I wrote my story on it for The Atlantic, and they said, well, it was Republican primary. You know, these are Republican voters, and we reached out to many organizations. And yet, you know, you've still had people in there who are going to clap and cheer. So I don't know what else they could have. When I say I don't know what they expected to happen, I'm actually worried that this is exactly what they expected to happen, and that because this was completely foreseeable as an outcome.
Talking to Tom Nichols from The Atlantic, looking at media coverage of the presidential election and of former President Trump running for a new nomination after a CNN town hall. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your own thoughts, maybe your own reactions if you watch that town hall. The number is 800-642-1234. Kay is with us now in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. I did watch the debate. I guess it was a debate. I thought that Caitlin Collins did a really good job of trying to fact check him, but it was impossible. And I had heard somewhere that they picked a certain amount of people for the audience that were Trump supporters, not just that were Republicans. So that might also account for the fact of the laughter sometimes and the clapping at some of his comments.
Okay, thanks a lot for sharing your thoughts, having seen that. Tom, it seems like there's some gray area in what CNN actually was looking for in establishing who is going to be in the audience. What do we know?
I just couldn't get an answer from that, and I tried twice. I mean, the CNN, their spokesperson went on Twitter and basically said, you know, here's how we did it. And again, the answer was kind of this general, well, we reached out to a lot of organizations, including the New Hampshire GOP. So, you know, but in the end, if the audience wasn't instructed to please be quiet, you know, while people were asking questions or while Collins was talking, it just wasn't going to happen. I think having a town hall format, for one thing, you know, this early, is just a mistake. There's nothing about Donald Trump that people don't know already. And Trump does not look at these as opportunities to explain his positions on anything. He looks at them as opportunities to make great TV. And apparently, I mean, it looks like that's what CNN wanted to do, was to make news and make great TV. But I don't think the public interest was served by pushing Caitlin Collins out there to try to fact check a guy who just doesn't bother with truth or reality.
Thanks for that call, Kay, at 800-642-1234. Tom, you know, when we do Wisconsin election coverage here, we'll look at a race, we'll establish a threshold, determine which candidates meet that. It might be ballot status or polling or whatever, varies from year to year. Would you feel better about this if CNN had said, okay, we'll invite Nikki Haley or certain other declared candidates who meet some kind of standard, so it's not just having one particular candidate on?
Well, my beef isn't with having any one candidate. It's the format that, you know, basically legitimizes and normalizes Trump's behavior. And I think that the only reason they went that road, I shouldn't say the only reason, I think an important reason they probably went that road is because Donald Trump was not going to agree to any other format. If they had said, look, we're going to sit you down one-on-one with a, you know, venerable older journalist who's an experienced interviewing hand, Trump probably would have said, well, I'm not doing it. You know, he's already said, I don't want to debate. You know, he wants to do rallies and he wants to do TV, and CNN said, okay. And they basically let him control the environment in a way I think you would not have seen, you know, some other candidate be able to do and demand. So it's not that they shouldn't talk to Trump or that they should or should not talk to Nikki Haley or Asa Hutchinson or anybody else. It's that the design of this event foreordained that it was going to become, you know, a circus, which is exactly what happened.
I think that it seems like there's a media instinct to say, okay, this is a legitimate candidate. We'll talk to him in this case, like we would any other a candidate. Going back to 2015, now through 2023, can you make the case to media people that he's unique enough that we, I guess, in the media need to be careful how we approach that?
He's the first president to defeat the peaceful transfer of power in American history. We transferred power from one party to another, but it was not peaceful. And he stood there and, in my view, incited it. So, no, he's not a typical candidate. You know, he is, he basically instigated an attack and encouraged people, and now threatens to pardon those same people who are in jail for that attack, an attack on the government and the Constitution of the United States. So no, you can't just cover him as if to say, well, you know, here's this guy who advocated violent sedition and has been held liable for sexual abuse. So now we're going to ask him what his debt policies are. That to me seems a dereliction of duty almost to say, well, we asked him and he wouldn't answer us. So now we're going to move on to what he would do with, you know, Ukraine and immigration and the deficit. Donald Trump doesn't care about policies. Donald Trump is trying to seize control of the government again for his own purposes. And I think to cover him any other way, I understand. I mean, this is a really tricky thing for journalists who, you know, you can't become advocates of candidates, but to treat Donald Trump as if the past 5 years just didn't happen, I think is really dangerous for a democracy.
We're talking to writer Tom Nichols from The Atlantic about Donald Trump's town hall event on CNN last week and the way the media covers the former president now running for the White House again. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think the media's responsibility should be when it comes to covering the former president and his new campaign? What do you want for your media coverage of that campaign? Do you think there should be more scrutiny, more fact-checking? And what do you think of that CNN town hall, the format? What would you like to see instead? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Tom Nichols, staff writer for The Atlantic, where he wrote a recent column on CNN's town hall event with former President Donald Trump, current presidential candidate, with us today to talk about how the media should cover Trump amid a criminal indictment, a civil sexual abuse verdict, and another run for president. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think the media should cover Trump? What does fair coverage look like to you for a candidate like Trump? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. And did you see the CNN town hall style event with the former president? What did you think about that? What could have worked better? Call in at 800-642-1234. Tom, one of the arguments from CNN about having Trump supporters in the crowd was, hey, these are real people, real voters. They should be represented on the media, including at an event with the former president.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty unconvincing from the head of CNN, who said, well, you know, these people have been ignored. That's just a laughable argument, considering how many times, as I said in the piece, how many times journalists have, you know, headed out to every diner and gas station in America to find some angry guy in a red hat and beg him, please tell us what you're mad about. Please, you know, explain why you're voting this way. I mean, this is actually one of the most studied parts of the electorate over the past 5 years. The minute Trump won, there were endless stories and academic studies as well of, you know, who are these voters and what do they want? And for CNN to say, well, you know, we really had to reach out to these folks because nobody pays attention to them, struck me as just laughable. And you'll notice that not something that's done with any other candidate. Nobody crisscrossed the country saying, we have to find these, you know, we have to find these Biden voters and find out why they're voting for Joe Biden, you know, what they want. This was something very specifically done with the Make America Great voters. And I thought that was just at best kind of risible and at worst kind of disingenuous about why they were stalking the audience. If they actually stalked the audience, but the idea that they were reaching out and saying, well, we have to talk to people who've been ignored. All we've been doing for 5 years is talking to people who voted for Trump and why they did it.
And if that Trump voter were out there listening right now, they might hear this conversation as a call for bias against their candidate. They might sense that the media was against Trump and his supporters already, and it might sound to them like you're calling for special rules targeting their candidate. What would you say to them?
I actually think that their candidate should be interviewed, but you can't let him slide when you ask a question like, will you accept the outcome of an election? And Caitlin Collins tried, and he said, if I think it's fair. Well, you know, what does that mean? Do you, I was a federal employee before I became a writer, I was a federal employee for 25 years. You know, I've sworn an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States, which is the same oath the president swears. You know, will you support and defend the Constitution of the United States? Because on January 6th, 2021, you did not. So what, you know, what can you say to reassure people that you will not attack the Constitution of the United States again? Now, if people hearing that think that that's a call for special treatment, I'm sorry, I can't help you. I think that if a person running to become yet again the commander in chief and the chief magistrate of the United States, to become the head of our Article II power in the Constitution, has to be held accountable for the anti-constitutional things that he did for 4 years, and simply gliding past it to say, well, you know, bygones, let's talk about the deficit, I think is just irresponsible. And I think it's irresponsible, an irresponsible way to interview him. But I also think it's irresponsible if people say, you know, move on, move along, in a way that I think those voters, Rob, I'll just add, I think a lot of those voters would not be that willing to move along if a Democratic candidate were found liable for sexual abuse, or had said that he might not accept the outcome of an election, and had been involved in some pretty dodgy stuff regarding things like the military and other institutions of the U.S. government. So, if anything, I think what I'm calling for is fairer treatment, and to stop treating Donald Trump like a child who will have a tantrum if you ask him hard questions.
Go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Joni is with us in Appleton. Joni, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Joni?
Well, I've been listening. I'm parked. I'm not driving, but I was driving along. I'm listening to this. And the thing that has always been extremely upsetting to me is how much free coverage Trump has always gotten from the media. They chase after him like he's gold or something. And I know that it's all revenue to be on the air, to have something that people are interested in. But just as your previous caller was saying, he's gotten away with so many things with the charges against him. And now he's been found liable for sexual abuse. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. He got so much free coverage when he was running against Hillary, because the media chased after him. So, and I really do think it was a disservice for CNN to cover him the way they did. It was just a free-for-all for him. I don't think that he should be covered unless he's going to be legitimately challenged with another debate or something similar, because he's just always got free rein. And it's so much disinformation. And the people that listened to it at the time don't go back and fact check. And then so many people, unfortunately, aren't interested in the real facts.
I gotcha. Joni, thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. Joni, pointing Tom toward, I think, going back to the early, even the Republican primary, where CNN, among others, gave a lot of free airtime to candidate Donald Trump.
Yeah, and he knew. I mean, the one thing Trump is really good at, I think he's one of the least intelligent people ever to hold the presidency, but he's very clever about marketing. And he knew how to get himself on television. And, you know, the problem is that once you've captured the camera, and I think your caller, I think Joni was absolutely right, you know, once he starts saying crazy things and false things, they're out there. They're, you know, it's hard, you know, the saying, right? A lie gets halfway around the world before the truth gets its pants on. And he knew that. And so there has really been no penalty for him to do that. I think if it makes folks feel any better about this, I think one of the reasons he lost in 2020 was that people got a really good look at him in those crazy press conferences that he was running every afternoon during COVID. where, you know, he finally started talking about, you know, injecting bleach and, you know, sticking, you know, UV light in your body and all of that. But I think that your caller is absolutely right. Doing it the way CNN did it was really the worst of all possible worlds, because it made him look like an ordinary candidate with some unusual opinions. He is not an ordinary candidate. He is someone who has been involved with and is offering to pardon people who committed sedition.
Joni, thanks a lot for that call. Tom, in our last minute or so, I want to talk about disinformation in the 2020 election. People still repeating claims about fraud that we knew were fake in November of 2020. How do you want to see the media tackle that, given that, you know, it's all been disproven, it's all been corrected, and it still keeps going out there from Trump and others?
Yeah, I'm not sure what to do about that. I mean, I was kind of hoping that, you know, Caitlin Collins was not going to move off of that issue, that, you know, the 2020 election was not falsified. And until Donald Trump is simply going to accept that, you know, there's no point in moving on with the conversation. I think part of the problem here is that one of the reasons it's so difficult to break through the fact-checking wall is that people, I think a lot of people who support Trump don't care about the facts. They believe what they believe. And if they, you know, they'll go to Facebook or they'll go to YouTube or they'll go to some other outlet. And we've seen this now with Fox, right? I mean, Fox has had to back up from the accusations it made. And a lot of Fox viewers said, fine, if you're not going to feed me what I want, then I'm going to go find it somewhere else. So Trump knows that. And I think journalists have to go in when talking to him, knowing that as well.
Tom, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Tom Nichols is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he's lead writer for their flagship newsletter called The Daily. He was with us today to talk about how the media should cover Donald Trump, misinformation, and potential threats to democracy. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, a rare plant was spotted in Wisconsin for the first time in decades. Check out that discovery and the wider search for elusive species here in the state. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. In just a few minutes, we'll hear about a space race between private companies trying to develop technologies in Earth's orbit and beyond. But here's another space race between two planets to see which one has the most moons in our solar system. As reported in the New York Times science section, the contenders are Jupiter and Saturn. No surprise, they're the biggest. Why shouldn't they have more moons? Recent counts had Jupiter at 95 moons, Saturn at 83, but hang on. New research found a bunch more moons around Saturn, and the International Astronomical Union is planning to add 62 new Saturn moons to the list, pulling it way ahead of Jupiter. Now, dial down your expectations of moons. These guys are like 1 or 2 miles long. They're shaped like potatoes. Is that really a moon? I don't get to decide. They could be the remains of larger moons that broke up for some reason. Now, here on Earth, we're still holding steady at one, but it's a pretty good moon. Moon news you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the race for space started as a contest for countries, but in the last 20 years, private businesses have taken center stage. Look behind the scenes of the companies racing for orbit and beyond with the author of the new book, When the Heavens Went on Sale. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about mothers.
Many of us are grateful for everything our mothers taught us. For Jana Rose Schleiss, she's thankful that her mother taught her how to be beautiful.
I learned how to be a woman from my mom. What I mean is, I learned how to express my femininity from her. This isn't unique to me. For a lot of people, our mother is our first beauty standard. We grow up thinking she's the prettiest woman in the world. For girls, at some point in our lives, we gotta decide what kind of woman we wanna be and how we present that to the world. Through a million minuscule choices, we express ourselves and our femininity. The older I get, the more I realize I've been modeling myself off mom in subtle and not so subtle ways. My mother was a teacher. She also had 5 kids and a dairy farm to help run. When we were younger, she didn't have time for frivolous beauty trends or anything that wasn't practical. My three sisters and I, however, wanted everything new and impractical the early aughts could offer. Blue eyeshadow, the infamous Rachel haircut, and oh my gosh, flip-flops. When my mother goes out, her routine is this. Makeup, mascara, a bit of eyeliner, lipstick, hair. A few curls applied to her cropped locks, then brush back. Accessories. She keeps her most worn jewelry in a shot glass in the kitchen cupboard. I don't know how this became the norm. It drives my father, who bought much of it, crazy. She dumps the glass out, chooses a pair of small hooped earrings, and puts the many gold rings she wears on her hands. She's ready. I'm 30 now, and I've had plenty of time to experiment with my femininity. For style, there was the mismatch floral print phase, the crop tops and platforms phase, and this was all just during college. My hair journey has been similarly chaotic. For the few years I was a wannabe hippie, I didn't cut or even brush my hair. I could tell it drove my mother nuts, but she had a light, perhaps sometimes passive-aggressive touch. I'd receive gift cards for haircuts and the quick aside of, run a comb through your hair and then we'll go. But overall, she knew I needed to work through this stuff on my own. I've been dyeing my naturally brunette hair red for 10 years. This vibrant hair has become my brand, if you will. A friend recently asked why I chose this color. I told the story of how it initially happened. I got a horrid haircut before studying abroad. I bought a box of dye and tried to take control of the situation. To my 20-year-old self, this made sense. But looking back, it's obvious why red is the ideal beauty standard to me. For as long as I can remember, my mom's hair has been dyed shades of auburn. By the way she carries herself, my mother has taught me to never be ashamed of my body. She's always seemed so comfortable in hers. Something I'm very thankful for in a world that sends women messages like, you're too fat, you're too tall, you're too loud, you're too assertive, you're too independent, and the choices you've made are wrong. When I was younger, my mom let me be whatever I needed to be. All through puberty and the many confusing chapters after, I could always come to mom. She'd take me and my questions about my body and beauty seriously. I have nieces now, and I know they're watching, taking in the variety of women around them. They giggle at my armpit fuzz, want to touch my nose ring. They'll grow into their femininity one day too, play around with it and try different things. I'm so grateful they have many strong and beautiful women in their lives to take cues from. When I go out, my routine is this. Makeup, mascara, brows, lipstick. Hair, a few curls, brushed back. Accessories. From a jewelry box, I choose a variety of cheap gold rings and a pair of earrings. I know I'm ready. I know I'm beautiful because of mom.
Jana Rose Schleiss brought us that story on her beautiful mother. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. Space used to be considered the fictional final frontier, science fiction explorers going where no one had gone before. Then real-life countries started to make space travel a reality. People in orbit, then on the moon, probes to our nearest planetary neighbors and beyond, powered by national space agencies and big-name contractors. But then things changed. Our next guest says there was a major turning point when space suddenly became a new open field for private industry and lots of companies who've gotten in on the act. That, he says, is the greatest technology story of our time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you follow the latest news on space, rockets, and what's going on in Earth's orbit? Have you been following the trials and tribulations of SpaceX, Blue Origin, or the smaller rocket and space commerce startups out there? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Ashley Vance is a feature writer at Bloomberg Businessweek and the host of the Bloomberg show Hello World, which focuses on inventors and scientists. His books include Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. His newest book is called When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. Ashley, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
I think when people think of, you know, newer companies getting into the space business, they might think of SpaceX and Elon Musk. Your book highlights there is a lot going on beneath that surface. Can you talk about the variety of players in this rising industry?
Yeah, I mean, SpaceX definitely, I argue in the book, was this inciting incident for what has come since. I don't think most people are aware, which is why I wanted to write this thing, that there are dozens of rocket startups all around the world. There are hundreds of satellite startups all around the world. There are entire nations that are becoming spacefaring nations for the first time. And we're in a bit of a race right now among all these commercial companies to put up many thousands of times more satellites around the Earth than have ever existed before.
What led to the transition between, like I said, you know, a space program is your space agency and some really big name contractors in the aerospace industry, to the idea that lots more players can come in and, you know, maybe with some government support and contracts, of course, and try lots of smaller experimental things?
A lot of it was timing and then also a mentality shift. I think we reached a point where there had been huge advances in materials, huge, huge advances in electronics that helped bring the cost of these rockets down, the cost of satellites down, that made them better, and that also made it feasible for smaller teams to try and do these things as opposed to nation states. And then I think it was just this awakening. Space, it seems futuristic and advanced and all that, but it had been stuck for about 60 years. The underlying technology really had not changed much. And so you suddenly had a group of people who believed they could have a clean slate and do something new.
You share a lot of the personalities behind this as well as the technology. And one of the most interesting ones I thought was this chance meeting, an argument actually at a bar between a bunch of self-proclaimed space hippies and then a military, an Air Force general who had worked on the Strategic Defense Initiative for Star Wars and black operations and things like that. And this was a pivotal moment. Can you share a little of that story?
Yeah, this general's name is Pete Warden. He's one of my favorite people and characters in the book. He was an astrophysicist by training. He was in the Air Force, but through his decades in the military and the government, he'd always been this iconoclastic figure who really wanted to do space differently. And through a series of events, he ended up inheriting becoming the director of NASA Ames, which is Silicon Valley's NASA center. And he took this as an opportunity to not just change NASA, but space overall. And there was this group of youngsters that he'd met at some of these space conferences. They were space hippies. They were idealistic. They also wanted to do different things in space. And so he flooded NASA Ames with all these 20-somethings. And, you know, NASA had this allergic reaction to this idea they could do things cheaper and better, but many of these people succeeded, and they've started a lot of these commercial space companies that we have today.
Now, we might see some of the higher profile, you know, rocket launches, like the most recent one from SpaceX, but it seems like a big part of the story is this explosion, I guess, not so dramatic as that one, but a huge rise in the number of satellites up in Earth's lower orbit. Can you talk about the scale of the growth in our satellites?
I don't think people are aware of this, but they should be, which is why I wrote the book. But from about 1960 to 2020, we had a sum total of 2,500 satellites in low Earth orbit. And just in the last 3 years, that number has gone up to 8,000. It's going to double next year. It's going to reach 100,000 satellites within the next decade and possibly keep growing from there. And I argue in the book, what we're doing is building what I describe as a computing shell around the Earth. This is the next stage of our technological advancement and infrastructure. And it just happens to be taking place over our heads, as opposed to doing things like laying fiber optic cables under the ground here on Earth.
We're talking to Ashley Vance about his new book, When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? What hopes or fears do you have about the commercialization of space? What role should governments, say the U.S. government or international organizations, have in regulating it? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the commercialization of space with Ashley Vance. His new book is When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Superior. Mike, hi.
Hi. I've traveled 49 states and I was looking for the darkest experiences, from the loneliest road in Nevada to the southern Alaska. And I found that the best dark sky viewing I've ever seen in my life is in the northern, far northern tip of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan called Brockway Mountain. And that summer sky there is probably as close to it as any place could be. And it pains me because one night I was up there and I saw what I would call a string of pearls. And I think it was a recent Elon Musk launch of satellites. And it was like six satellites all in a row. And it just pains me to be thinking that those dark skies are going to be completely gone. So if anybody from Wisconsin or the Midwest hears this and wants to see it before it does fade, Mount Brockway up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan is probably the best dark sky that I've seen in any of the 49 states.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Mike, not the only one concerned, Ashley, about the changing vision of our night sky because of artificial satellites. I know there's some scientific concern from astronomers as well. Are we going to see enough satellites up there that it's really going to spoil our view?
Yeah, those were almost certainly the SpaceX satellites he was talking about for their Starlink internet system. And this is why I wrote the book now. Nobody's paying attention to this stuff. I mean, my book is optimistic overall because these things are going to do some very important functions for us. But to be honest, you can just expect more and more of that. This is going to be a regular occurrence. Astronomers are concerned. Other people are concerned. I was sort of shocked that astronomers voiced these concerns so late, because we were all knew what SpaceX was going to do. There is some inevitability to all this now.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. And on a related note, Ashley, it's not just looking crowded from here on Earth. There are more and more satellites from governments and militaries and startups, so many that there's another startup that's kind of acting as an air traffic controller?
That's right. Yeah, there's a company called Leo Labs, and obviously we've had government systems for tracking objects in space. This company has built a new type of antenna. They're building a network of antennas around the world. They can see pretty much every object in space down to a couple of centimeters, so even debris from things. But this is the stage we're at. It's great that this company exists. It's also a small 50-person startup that is now in charge of leading the way on managing all of this. And this is, again, the reality people need to be aware of.
Is there a thought that some more organized body is going to come in and start regulating this? I mean, I just try to picture we've got all these airplanes in the sky and then some guy started a business to help make sure they don't crash into each other. It doesn't sound like an ideal system to me.
It's in everyone's best interest, obviously, that this works, especially the satellite companies, because if you have a crash, you have every chance of creating this kind of cascading debris field. And the federal regulators are looking over this. I think they are having trouble keeping up with the pace that this industry is going. They're used to this 60, 70 year old pace that's flipped very quickly. And so I'm not, it's just not at all clear how this is going to play out. But again, for these companies, it's essential that they figure this out. And so they want all of this to work.
Talking to Ashley Vance about his new book, When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. Ashley, so much of your book is you on the ground, checking out these companies as they succeed or fail at their various experiments. Which companies struck you as ones that, even if they're not household names right now, maybe they should be?
Well, there's a company called Rocket Lab, which is based in New Zealand and was founded by this guy named Peter Beck. And it's an incredible story. He never even went to college. He worked as an apprentice at a dishwasher manufacturer and was building rockets in a shed behind his house. He was making his own propellants. He ended up creating a rocket and then another one, and now a very large company that's valued at several billion dollars and is the second coming of SpaceX. He did all this in New Zealand, which has no aerospace history. He's set pretty much every first you can have for the Southern Hemisphere in terms of aerospace. And just in it's a story that I think points to how far we have come from this being something pursued just by nation states, just by billionaires, that this driven individual and his team were able to pull this off.
Another individual key to another one of these companies you talk about in the book is a Ukrainian named Max Polyakov. I hope I'm saying his name right. Can you share about his story and the company he helped created and ultimately had to leave?
Max is maybe the tragedy in the book. He was an OBGYN by training. He shifted his career in Ukraine to become this multimillionaire software magnate. His parents both worked on the Soviet space program. And a company in Texas that was building a rocket went bankrupt called Firefly, and Max bought it. He put $250 million into this company. Max is an incredibly eccentric, driven, quite chaotic individual, and he ends up being thrown out of his company by the U.S. government. You could check out the book to sort of see how this interplays with the war in Ukraine. But yes, I mean, this is the drama that's taking place in this industry as politics and commerce and all of these new realities collide.
Speaking of realities, this may feel, you know, a way away from us here in Wisconsin, startup companies around the world, stuff happening up in low Earth orbit. How are we going to be feeling the impact of this expansion in the satellites and the things they're doing in the next few years?
The most immediate things that these thousands of satellites are doing are the space internet that we talked about. And so people probably listening have a number of them probably have Starlink, where you get high speed internet in a place you previously could not be reached by high speed internet. That same story is true for 3.5 billion people around the world. And then there's a huge class of imaging satellites, which are, as opposed to images from space being rare and very expensive, we are now flooded with millions upon millions of images that capture everything happening, literally everything happening on Earth every day. A company called Planet Labs is the leader in this. And so we're getting this picture of the, I call it like the sum total of human activity on Earth. And in the Midwest in particular, farmers are using these satellites to check on the health of their crops. They can see how much chlorophyll is in the crops and the ideal time to harvest them and the health of their fields.
One thing that struck me just from you being on the ground at so many of these sites, and you write about this, we might picture, you know, a rocket lab, a launch facility as this like amazing piece of set design from the most elaborate science fiction movie. And tell us about the reality. What do these places really look like?
Some of the startups are pretty fancy. Rocket Lab's got some fancy things, but the actual launch sites themselves are crazy. they tend to be near the equator. The Earth actually spins faster at the equator. It gives these rockets some extra boost, and that they're also tend to be by water, so they don't blow up and hurt things and people. And so I went to India, I went to French Guiana, I went to Svalbard, which is another extreme at sort of the farthest north on our planet. And this is where much of the space infrastructure is. It's quite dated. A lot of this was built in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And it's remote and quite poor. It was just such the opposite of what I was expecting going into reporting on space.
In just our last half minute, this is a business that changes quickly. What is the next big space story you have your eye on?
Well, I really think it's just watching to see if the business case behind all of this stuff arrives. We've pumped $280 billion into this industry. There seems to be a lot of promise, but now is the real test to see just how far this goes and which ones of my characters survive into the next chapter.
Ashley, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
That's Ashley Vance, a feature writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, host of the travel show Hello World. We talked to him today about his new book. It's called When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, religion in the United States has changed a lot in recent years, in some ways under the radar. That could all determine the outcome of the 2024 elections. Connect the dots from the pews to the polls. And a new history puts Native Americans at the center of the United States story. We'll meet the author of the new book, The Rediscovery of America. As always, you can join the conversation on the air or email ideas@WPR.org. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, with graduation season underway across Wisconsin, we'll get a look at the state's job market, find out what new high school and college grads can expect as they look for work. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.